From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 700 points this morning after news that a Chinese executive from the tech company Huawei was arrested in Canada at the request of the U.S. There's concern that this will further escalate the trade war with China days after a temporary truce. Congressman Ron Estes represents the 4th District in Kansas. He's a Republican. It's an area that depends on trade with China because of its agriculture. Congressman, when you saw the markets dropping today after this arrest, what did you make of it?
Well, I think there's probably two pieces of that. One, the stock market goes up and down. If you look at it the last couple of years, it's up a lot. You know, now in the last few weeks, it's been up and down on a week-by-week basis. So you'll see a lot of movement on the market depending on news that comes up. But I think one of the important things about the most recent news is that we've been in this ongoing trade war for a long period of time with countries like China, and you know, multiple cases that have been filed against them, and they found guilty of stealing intellectual property, and that's the concern. That we want free and fair trade. I mean, we want it in our manufacturing facilities, we want it in our agriculture areas, and we want to have open markets. And you know, if China wants to trade in a free world with open markets, then every country ought to follow the same rules, and we want to make sure that that happens.
So do you think that President Trump should get rid of the tariffs on China and other countries, or do you think that it's a good idea to keep them in place at the moment?
At the end of the day, tariffs are not a good idea. I mean, we want to have open markets. We want to have free trade. You know, in an ideal world, we wouldn't have any tariffs at all. And I think the president's even said that once or twice in G20.
But he did just call himself Tariff Man the other day. He said, I'm a tariff man.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the whole process to get to that free and fair trade is tariffs may be the only avenue that you have to really bring people to the table to negotiate.
How much are farmers in your district being hurt by the tariffs that are being put on products that they produce?
I think what we're seeing a lot is the anti-tariff reaction. We've seen some grain prices down, but then they were on the way down over the last 3-4 years. The farmers that I talk to, overwhelmingly, they want to have open markets. They want to have this dispute resolved, but they want to make sure that it's done fairly and make sure that it's a lasting agreement that works for everybody.
I want to ask you about taxes, because you were the state treasurer under Sam Brownback, the former governor there in Kansas, who was a big fan of tax cuts, put forward big tax cuts. Many looked at it and said they didn't work out the way that he wanted them to. And in fact, the Republican legislature ended up overriding his veto to get rid of them. What do you think about those tax cuts that happened in Kansas? Do you think that they were a failure?
Well, I think what you see is a couple of differences if you compare the Kansas tax cuts versus the tax cuts at the federal level. On one aspect, you didn't get the growth out of Kansas. At the time the tax cuts came in, the oil markets dropped. So oil and gas is one of the mainstays of the state. So you saw a decline in state revenue that would have happened regardless of what the tax rates were. On the federal level, when we look at the tax cuts here, the biggest piece that we're seeing is that strong positive economic growth, because we've given businesses, we've given individuals some reliability, some consistency of what to expect.
But also a big increase in the federal deficit as a result of those tax cuts.
Yeah. And what if you look at the Congressional Budget Office, which is kind of the nonpartisan office that does that. A year ago, when the tax plan was being brought up, it was estimated that over a 10-year period, just lowering the rates would result in a $1.5 trillion reduction in tax revenue. 5 months ago, when they did their semiannual review, they came back and said, oh, they're seeing more economic growth. So now over the next 10 years, they're seeing that $1 trillion of that is now coming back into the marketplace, so we'll have more tax revenue. So it's part of that economic growth. That was a big piece that we're seeing now that's so positive.
So you still think that the tax cuts are going to pay for themselves?
I do think they will pay for themselves over the 10-year period, and we've already seen signs of that. The Congressional Budget Office is starting to revise their numbers upward, so that's all positive signs.
What is it going to be like for you to go from being the majority in the House to the minority in the House as a Republican?
Well, I think one of those things that we want to make sure that we continue with the new 116th session is that we continue to get some things done. I know with the Democrats in the majority and Republicans in the minority, there may be a tendency to do pet projects and some political posturing. But it'd be disappointing if we spent the next year with a bunch of hearings and a bunch of investigations, and we really didn't do anything for the American people over the next 2 years.
I mean, were you saying the same thing, though, about what Republicans did with some of the investigations into Benghazi and other things when they were in control?
Well, I think there's a responsibility that we need as a legislative branch to have that checks and balances on the executive branch. But at the end of the day, the American people look to us to actually get results and get things done. And there's so many areas that we can agree on. I mean, from a standpoint of supporting our veterans, making sure tax cuts get permanent. There's also some looming problems out there. Social Security, we're spending down the money that had been put aside for the baby boomers. If we just follow the same model we did back in the 1980s that extended the life of Social Security then, and we need to come back and do some things like that.
Well, what do you mean? Do you mean raising the age for Social Security or making it so that you can only get it if you are at a certain income level? Or what does that mean?
So part of what was done back in the 1980s was several different changes. One of them was raising the retirement age from 65 to 67.
So what do you think it should be now?
Well, we're looking at, you know, when Social Security was created in 1937, the average life expectancy was 63, and the 65 was set as the retirement age. Now, with our average life expectancy going into the 70s, we need to come back and revisit that just from a – you've got to figure out ways to make the math work. So I don't have a fixed number as a retirement age, but I think that's one of those things we need to look at is just some of those options that were looked at in the 1980s and basically repeat that model.
That is Congressman Ron Estes, a Republican who represents the 4th District in Kansas. Congressman, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, former President George H.W. Bush will be buried today at his presidential library on the campus of Texas A&M University in College Station. His death and the services yesterday in Washington and today in Houston have brought so many memories for those of his life, including for people from the former Soviet Union, memories of the late President Bush's legs. Reporter Dina Prichip explains.
As the Soviet Union began to unravel in the late 1980s, the supply chain broke down. It's a picture a lot of people remember.
You would have people standing in lines to get especially scarce things like vodka, but increasingly also cheese, bread, milk.
Yanni Katsonis teaches Russian economic history at NYU. To handle these shortages, the Soviet Union made trade deals, and in 1990, they made one with America to get surplus chicken, which, for the U.S., means dark meat.
So very suddenly, there's a flood of chicken legs on the market. And where did they come from? Well, it was announced as a deal between the United States, led by President Bush, or HW, and Mikhail Gorbachev of the Soviet Union. And the nickname immediately caught on that these are Bush's legs or Bush's feet. Nozhki Busha.
Each Bush leg was like the size of a Soviet chicken, or at least it seemed sort of that way. It was like an elephant next to a chihuahua.
Anya Yulinich is a writer in Brooklyn. As a teenager in Moscow, Yulinich says Bush legs were her first introduction to the president.
While Reagan was a big rock star, I guess nobody really paid attention to Bush.
But people paid attention to Bush legs. Historian Yanni Katsonis says that in the 1990s, about 70% of Russian chicken was imported. And most of that was from the U.S.
Sure, it was motivated by Bush's good connections with the poultry industry. But it also represented a very real form of diplomacy. And I lament the loss of that kind of diplomacy.
But Katsonis acknowledges that around the same time Russians were embracing the soft diplomacy of delicious bush legs, they were also watching the bombings of the first Gulf War and thinking about their own dependence on the country behind it. For a lot of Russians who lived through it, it's a complicated question.
I can picture these juicy leg quarters, like nicely browned, coming out of the oven in my grandmother's kitchen.
Sasha Senderovich teaches Russian studies at the University of Washington and fondly remembers the ample size of bush legs and the fact you didn't have to stink up your apartment singeing off unplucked feathers like with Soviet birds. And yet,
the bush legs were the the sort of first, you know, whatever, foot soldiers of American capitalism you sent eastwards to lay the groundwork for all the rest that followed.
With perestroika came not only American chicken, but a loosening of political humor, including, Senderovich remembers, jokes about this.
The bushlegs tells to the Soviet chicken, oh, you look so small and you look so sickly and, you know, look at me, I'm so healthy and I'm so large and so much bigger than you. And then the Soviet chicken responds, but I died my own death.
Like a lot of Russian humor, this can be kind of hard to parse. Is the joke on the scrawny Soviet bird who thinks he's noble? Or the capitalist American bird who isn't? Or the Soviet consumer stuck between these two? Either way, it's a thing of the past. Import sanctions over the last decade took bushlegs off the Russian menu. But for millions of former Soviets, the delicious and complicated memory remains. For Here and Now, I'm Dina Prichett.
The new film Mary, Queen of Scots begins at the end with Mary Stuart heading to the executioner's block in 1587 at the age of 44. But we then learn how she got there. The young Queen Mary, a Catholic raised in France for her safety because of religious turmoil in Scotland, returns home to rule her country at the age of 18. But Protestants are now in control of Scotland, and of course, they reign in England, where Mary has a claim to that throne as well, but it's occupied by Queen Elizabeth, played by Margot Robbie. Mary, played by Saoirse Ronan, is hoping the older Elizabeth doesn't have an heir and clears a path for her.
I shall respect Elizabeth's crown as soon as she names me its successor.
Madam, my
if
queen
if she has
will
any
not
concerns about this proposal, she may express them to me directly.
Well, the two queens both face misogyny, but instead of forming a sisterhood, they get inside each other's heads and, well, Mary loses hers. Mary, Queen of Scots is director Josie Rourke's first film. She's also the artistic director of London's Dunmar Warehouse Theatre Company. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hi.
Also joining us, screenwriter Beau Willimon, who also was the creator of the Netflix show House of Cards. So he is familiar with the metaphorical sharp weapons and backstabbing. Beau, welcome to you as well.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
And I do want to start with you, Beau, because we know that this film was based on the book Queen of Scots, The True Life of Mary Stuart by Dr. John Guy, who was said to find research that others hadn't seen before. Just tell us, what didn't we know? What does Dr. John Guy tell us?
John Guy's book really challenged a lot of the stereotypes we have had about Mary and Elizabeth over the years. Oftentimes, Mary is portrayed as impulsive and reckless, over-emotional, naive, and Elizabeth is portrayed as being cold, calculated, and shrewd. And really, both of those are wrong. Mary was really quite deliberate and politically savvy with the choices that she was making, and Elizabeth at that time was quite indecisive and insecure. And in many ways, Mary's challenge to her own legitimacy burnished Elizabeth into becoming the Elizabeth that we've all come to know. Mm. So we really wanted to tell a story that made us rethink these two women and really allow them to tell their own stories rather than let the historiography of a lot of people that have had it out for Mary over the centuries do the storytelling for us.
And Josie, here you are, a female director. We have these two female leads.
That's a lot of women, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah. And I want more, you know, because, yeah, you know, the depth of it and the fact that it could just devolve into a catfight, and it doesn't. What was important for you to bring out in these two women?
I think that Beau really hit the nail on the head there, that what we're trying to do is avoid the stereotype of them. And I think the stereotype is one was cold and calculating, one was emotional and incompetent. And I just don't think that's borne out by the detailed reality that John Guy went into so forensically, nor do I think it actually reflects women's lives in, let's call it a workplace. I mean, obviously they were crowned heads of Europe, but I think we're now in a position where what we need to start to do is tell better and more honest stories about the realities of leadership for women. Mm. And this canvas gave us an opportunity to do that.
Well, and also, you know, we forget that these two women were so extraordinary in their time. They are surrounded by men who just as soon kill them, and they have a fascination with each other.
Yeah, and that fascination is because they are literally on the same island. They're both doing the same job, and nobody else is doing that job. Only they can know what it is like to be the other. And this is a bit of a strange analogy, but if you think of, you know, the kind of Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty axis, where you go, yeah, okay, you've got the sort of villain and hero in both of them, but actually what runs through those books and all the really great screen adaptations of that story are two people who have the intelligence and the sympathy and the understanding that really drives them to simply want to be in the same space and want to look each other in the eye. And there's great drama in the root of that. Yeah. Beau, of course, realised that in this extraordinary, imagined, climactic scene of the film in which those two queens do look at each other face to face.
And Beau, tell us about that, because as we said, much of the film is based on the research of Dr. John Gaia and his book, again, Queen of Scots. But that scene is imagined.
That's right. We decided to take a liberty, and that was to have these two women meet. And we did it for a few reasons. I mean, oftentimes historical fact as portrayed literally can actually fall short in giving the audience access to the true complexity and dynamic between two characters. And running through the core of the story for us was the notion, which history supports, that ultimately these two women, their instincts were to find ways to coexist with one another amicably. And yet the political tectonic plates of the time really prevented them from being able to. And the only way for us to fully dramatize the emotional complexity of that was to put them face to face rather than simply rely on epistolary storytelling through correspondence.
But do you ever have any hesitation about that? I mean, this is film. And this is entertainment primarily, but so much of it is historic. And for many, it's going to be a first telling to have a scene that, you know, that didn't exist.
Yeah, well, I could ask the same question of Shakespeare, really, right? I mean, you look at all of, you know, his history plays where he took much wilder liberties than we have with this film. And the reason he's doing it is because there's an emotional or essential truth that he's trying to get to in revealing something to you about the character. And there's also a narrative expectation from the audience that we've followed these two women over the course of this film, and it would be a shame not to have these two great characters played by these two extraordinary actors share the same screen at the same time. You would be subverting a narrative expectation that has quite a pull to it.
Yeah. I think it's also important to add that that scene of those two queens meeting, this is not to say that Beau hasn't done the definitive version of it, but, you know, Katharine Hepburn's played that scene. Mm-hmm. Helen Mirren has played that scene. Vanessa Redgrave and Eileen Atkins have played that scene. It's not totally an innovation, I'm afraid.
No. Let's just talk a little bit about what people might need to know before they go into the film. The bare bones plot, which is Mary Scott's claim to the throne of England. She was the senior descendant of King Henry VIII of England's older sister. And so that's sort of the basis of her claim. And also it has to do with who's going to be able to produce an heir first, Elizabeth or Mary? But it would seem as if Elizabeth, you know, seems to agree a little bit with Mary's claim. And here's a scene with Queen Elizabeth, again played by Margot Robbie, speaking to her Privy Council, who have constantly plotted to deprive Mary of the throne. After all, she's a Catholic. This is England. And they expressed horror at the possibility of a Catholic becoming the Queen of England. Let's listen.
Despite your every effort, she has prevailed. She has proven herself, in fact, far more capable than my own Privy Council. Should I die before my time, we could do worse than to place her on the throne of England.
Beau, is that an accurate historical sentiment?
Yes, the Privy Council in England desperately want to do anything they could to dethrone or delegitimize Mary. But what you see time and time again is Elizabeth beginning to question their advice and actually consider the possibility of Mary becoming her heir. And that's actually what Mary was angling for. If Mary could get Elizabeth to agree that she would be the heir, assuming that Elizabeth didn't have any children, then they would have been able to coexist peaceably. And they came very close to making that deal.
Josie, this film is coming. I mean, you might as well just sit back and watch throngs go towards it, because it's coming at a time when it's clear. We're hungry for these stories. You have The Favorite, you have The Crown, you have Victoria. So much fascination with these women. What do you think that is?
I think that to an extent has always been the case. Beau referenced Shakespeare before, and great writers have always enjoyed writing about great and troubled leaders. I also think that what we're beginning to see, and I've got great hope and joy for this, really, is a powerful sense, which seemed to slip away from us for a while, that a woman or women can sit as the leads in a movie. And what's certainly true, having spent most of my career in the theatre, is that, you know, you are looking quite hard to find the same volume in the canon of leading parts for women as you are for men. So really, this reminting of these big classic roles and thinking and rethinking about women in power and leadership and what that means, and actually the honesty with which their stories are being told, I think is a really positive cultural moment and comes from partly a commercial desire, because actually women are going to sell tickets and people are going to want to go and see that, but also just a quiet passion to have those stories better told with more humanity.
Do you feel some personal satisfaction that Mary's story has been retold? I mean, in the end, she gives birth to James. After Elizabeth dies, James rules a united Britain.
In some ways, his two parents aren't necessarily Mary and Darnley, but his two parents really are Mary and Elizabeth. It was, in a way, them achieving some form of union, because Elizabeth helped raise James. James was in many ways closer to Elizabeth than to his own imprisoned mother, and he did unify both those kingdoms. So Mary, in her own fashion, did win at the end of the day, but I think Elizabeth did too, because she also found a way to maintain her power and ultimately create a space for James. So they both navigated it in their own fashion, and, you know, unfortunately for Mary, with great cost.
I should actually probably say just before, given that I live in England, my doormat fills up with letters from Scottish nationalists, that he unified the two kingdoms in holding titles over both, but he did govern them separately. So it wasn't the union that we now have.
Well, and this, I'm sure this is resonating in a completely unique way to England and Scotland.
You can say Brexit. Yeah.
Just a beautiful, powerful film. We've been speaking with screenwriter Bo Willimon and the director Josie Rourke. It is Mary, Queen of Scots. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The big players in the digital advertising industry are feeling some heat from who else? Amazon. The retail giant has increasingly been selling ads on its web pages, in its search results, even the boxes customers get in the mail. And Amazon has now taken the number 3 spot in the U.S. digital ad market behind the dominant players Google and Facebook. That means if you use Amazon, you're seeing more advertising, and companies selling products on Amazon are facing more competition. Here Now media analyst John Carroll joins us with the details. Hi, John.
Hello, Jeremy.
And first of all, just give us a sense of the lay of the land here. How big is the digital advertising industry?
Right. Online ad spending should reach about $106 billion this year.
Wow.
Google has maybe 40% of it, Facebook around 21%, Amazon has 4%. So that still makes them number 3. Their ad sales are projected to double in the next 2 years and then double again by 2020.
So what are the different ways that Amazon reaches customers with its ads, presents ads on its website?
Yeah, most of it's in its retail sites. You can be a sponsored product and get up higher in the search results. But they also have video ads. They have traditional display ads. They have product ads alongside search results. As you noted, they can even buy the boxes that get delivered to people's homes.
And I imagine that one of the appeals of Amazon for advertisers over, let's say, Google, is that if you're on Amazon, you probably got your credit card out and you're ready to buy something.
Right. For starters, over 50% or nearly 50% of U.S. e-commerce sales happen on Amazon, and about 50% of product searches begin on Amazon. So they have a lot of information about consumers, and they have information about what you've bought, not just what you where you've been. So the other thing that is important to people is what Amazon calls a seamless shopping experience. So it's one stop. You search, you buy, and you're done.
And in this world that we're living in now, some of the searching is happening without the help of Google. That's got to be part of this as well.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there are apps, there are email newsletters. One marketer said Google is kind of quaint at this point. It feels wow. like a little bit from
still
the
pretty huge,
from the past.
But yes, okay.
Totally huge, yes.
So isn't it awkward for companies to advertise on Amazon when their products are appearing next to many similar products from other brands? And Amazon has dozens of private label products that it's also displaying prominently.
Right. Amazon has this walled retail garden where they advertise products, they sell products. Sometimes they're in competition with each other. And what they're doing here is basically saying, if you pay us to marketers and retailers, if you pay us, we'll level the playing field for you. That is because so much of Amazon business comes from the searches that start there. 90% of searches on Amazon result in purchases. It's a sandbox that that brands really want to play in. So they pay a little more, but then they get more elements like consumer reviews that can boost sales too.
The Wall Street Journal reported last week that there were complaints about Amazon-sponsored ads on its baby registries.
Right. Amazon was slipping sponsored products into mother's baby registry lists, and they weren't labeling them very clearly. Customers called it called it kind of sneaky. Amazon said it's phasing it out. But this is a tug of war that's going to go on between Amazon and consumers for a while. They're going to be pushing the envelope, and consumers are going to be pushing back.
And if you've got complaints, I guess you can send them to Long Island City or Crystal City, Virginia.
Either
John
one,
Carroll,
yeah.
Media analyst for Here and Now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Former President George H.W. Bush is being buried today in Texas after several days of remembrance. Today at the funeral service in Houston, the choir sang his favorite hymn, Onward, Christian Soldiers. So as we look back on the legacy of the 41st president, how much are we getting right? And how much do we get right about the legacies of all of our former presidents after they die? For a look back at that history, we're joined by Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
And we have to go to the very first one, Joanne, which is President George Washington. How did his legacy evolve after he died?
Well, here's the interesting thing about Washington. I mean, it's no surprise that when he died, his reputation was pretty high, right? He was already the father of his country when he was alive. But what's interesting is that after his death, the Federalist Party tried to manipulate his reputation to boost it, to be even stronger and to be useful to them in a partisan kind of a way. Mm-hmm. So they did all kinds of things like trying to give him full credit for things that he didn't necessarily do on his own. So, for example, the farewell address, his famous farewell address, Alexander Hamilton helped him with that, and the Federalists tried to hide the proof of that from the public and from Hamilton's descendants so that Washington could have full credit for it and so that his reputation would be so powerful that the Federalists could basically use it forever.
Well, and Washington doesn't have a Broadway show, so at least there's that. Hamilton's got the show now so that,
that
everybody can hear all about his accomplishments. Nathan, what about a president whose legacy really changed after his death?
Well, one that comes immediately to mind is someone like Andrew Jackson, who was president from 1829 to 37. And, you know, during his life, he was considered to be a champion of the common man. He was a war hero. But also in the context of slavery, he helped to basically democratize the slave institution with accumulating land holdings from Native Americans, making it difficult for central banks to buy land and really, you know, squeeze the common man with loans and such. So the combination of Jackson's Indian policy and his stance against central banks made him very popular in life and, frankly, an enemy of the elite. I mean, the way in which he talked about the tyranny of the banks was thrown right back at him by his enemies who coined him as King Andrew the First. And you can imagine tyranny is kind of like what the Cold War would be relative to communism, right? You just simply throw the epithet around and hope that it sticks effectively. Now, what happens, of course, with Jackson is that even though he has a high reputation, and this is through the 20th century, people are naming schools after Jackson and such, you know, mm-hmm. well into the post-World War II period. So you have a number of Americans who see Jackson's name on schools as a marker of, again, the everyman and using it sometimes to displace African Americans in the era of eminent domain and such, you know, land possession. So suffice it to say that in the 1970s, there's a real shift where if you focus on Native American politics and kind of a Red Power movement, there's a radical reinterpretation of what Jackson means. The Trail of Tears is obviously one of the real negative chapters in American history. And there's an idea that, you know, Jackson should not be remembered for his ability to advance slavery and the slave power to the point now in 2015, 2018 and after, you know, we're thinking about Jackson on the $20 bill and whether or not he should remain at all or be effectively displaced by someone like Harriet Tubman.
But at the same time, we've also got President Trump, who's a huge fan of Andrew Jackson, talks about him all the time, I think has a picture of him in the Oval Office.
Precisely for the reasons that many people thought he was a hero during the 1950s and during the 1830s, right? There's a way in which he represents a particularly narrow vision of American democracy that resonates with part of Trump's base, to be sure.
Okay, let's get to another one that is thought of today as one of the greatest, if not the greatest president we've ever had, and that would be Abraham Lincoln. Was that always the case that he was remembered in that way?
Well, now, it's interesting because, you know, when they poll professors of various sorts and ask them to rate presidents, you're right. Lincoln is always towards the top of those lists. Mm-hmm. But in fact, his reputation had both highs and lows in the wake of his death. Now, of course, he was a wartime president. He was assassinated just a few days after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox. And we had just had a bloody civil war. So for Northerners, Lincoln really kind of was a martyr for the Union. He had an extremely high reputation. Mm. Not surprisingly, in the South, he was seen as something of a tyrant and had pretty much a negative reputation. And what's
interesting, there's that word again.
Yes, there is that word again. And what's interesting is in the South, that persisted for quite some time. So there's a story about in 1910, so we're talking the 20th century, and there was an eighth grader named Oscar Chapman who actually was expelled from his school in Virginia for hanging a portrait of Lincoln in his school. Yeah, and his teacher was shocked. She had to apologize to parents. Little Oscar gets expelled. And the parents ultimately get him back into school not by saying, wait a minute, Lincoln isn't as bad as you're suggesting he is, but rather by saying, well, you failed the curriculum because you didn't teach our son properly the evils that Lincoln did, which is shocking. That's 1910 we're talking about.
But now we've got the Lincoln Memorial in just as prominent a place in Washington as you could say the Capitol and the Washington Monument.
Exactly, exactly. So, and that monument in and of itself was seen as a device or an attempt to unify the nation behind Lincoln, to do so in the nation's capital, so on sort of neutral ground, you could say. But even that attempt had its divisions because the audience that was there watching the memorial get commemorated was segregated. So you end up with the black press saying a segregated audience at that particular moment is the ultimate in hypocrisy, and the white mainstream press basically ignoring that complaint altogether and just praising the unity of the memorial. So even at that moment of unity, there isn't necessarily unity.
I want to ask about one more president, and that is one, the only one, that resigned in office, and that would be Richard Nixon. We actually just visited the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California, and did a story about it. And one of the things a historian there said is, you know, Watergate, yes, it was very important, but there was actually a lot more to Nixon's legacy than Watergate. And he started talking about all these great things that Nixon did. What is Nixon's legacy been like throughout these last few decades?
So when Nixon resigned in August of 1974, I mean, his approval rating was somewhere around 24%. So with numbers that low, you know, it can only really go up, right? But if you think about the kind of terrain that Nixon tried to stake out, oftentimes for political expediency, there were a lot of things that were considered to be positive. You know, for one, he was seen as someone who, for instance, tried to unify working classes and elites around basically building a new political coalition for the Republican Party. That meant reaching out to disaffected Southern Democrats. That meant trying to reach out to white moderates by supporting things like affirmative action and even black capitalism, which is an effort to get entrepreneurship to be a real engine of economic growth in communities of color. So all these efforts to build new coalitions effectively made Nixon something of a political, you know, savant. The other other thing about this, of course, is that he's supporting environmentalism in ways that might seem out of step with the contemporary GOP, at least. So mm-hmm. he creates the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. He helps to pass the Clean Air Act that same year, Clean Water Act in 72, and the Endangered Species Act of 73. None of this would be considered to be pillars of present-day Republican politics, but we have to look to this as part of Nixon's legacy. Similarly, on foreign policy, he issues a strategy of détente, which is considered to be a really successful negotiation of the Soviet Union, of China. And this is a far cry from what would become, say, the Bush Doctrine of preemptive strikes in the early 2000s. So again, as Republican foreign policy goes, he's considered to be much more progressive, or at least moderate.
Well, that brings us to today and this week and what we've been thinking about as we've been looking back at the presidency of George H.W. Bush. And Joanne, I think in the back of everyone's mind, as you remember the things that he did, you're looking at President Trump and how much the party, his party, has changed.
Well, right. It's a really interesting moment, culturally and politically, a really interesting moment, because the sort of mourning for Bush, so much of it is really appears to be, or it's being made into a moment of people mourning for some sense of decency in politics. They're mourning for something that goes far beyond Bush. And of course, his reputation along the lines of what we're talking about here is being shaped by our current moment and the feelings and problems and controversies and anxieties that people have right now about politics and American society.
Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
The Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal continues to plague USA Gymnastics and Nassar's victims. Yesterday, the organization filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, hoping that will expedite processing dozens of civil lawsuits related to Nassar, the former national medical coordinator for USA Gymnastics, convicted of assaulting young gymnasts under the guise of medical care. In January, he was sentenced to more than 175 years in prison. More than 150 women and girls have accused him of assault, including top American gymnasts Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, and Gabby Douglas. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, help us with this, because USA Gymnastics says this isn't a liquidation, it's a reorganization. But how does that help expedite these lawsuits?
Well, I don't think it does, and the victims and their lawyers don't think it does. Mm. On the contrary, they think that this will delay any payouts that could happen. And we should say Michigan State has begun to give some payouts, and they're going to be paying at a higher dollar value. The insurance, and USA Gymnastics is insured, the insurance covers them for somewhere between $75 and $100 million. But it is seen, even though USA Gymnastics says this will get us to a process of paying claims sooner, it is seen as another bureaucratic hurdle before you get to the claims. So a bankruptcy court would just look at this as a bankruptcy, and they'd look at the victims as claimants,
right,
and the order of paying the claimants doesn't supersede the fact that they have to go through the bankruptcy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you have creditors when you – you know, still like a creditor when you declare bankruptcy, you don't necessarily have to pay them all. Look, where does this leave the USA Gymnastics program? Because it's run through leaders. And didn't the U.S. Olympic Committee take steps just last month to revoke its certification for the Olympics? So, you know, will there even be a U.S. gymnastics team at the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo?
Okay, I'll take the last question first. There will definitely be a U.S. gymnastics team. Americans will participate in the Olympics, and if it's Simone Biles, will win gold and lots of gold. I don't know. And at this point, from my reading, I don't think that USA Gymnastics will be the NGB, the national governing body. And that might not make too much of a difference to those of us at home or to those of us who are maybe fans of the Olympics. There'll be some entity. This entity will take over. The entity that was this Indianapolis-based nonprofit called USA Gymnastics that did not handle the Larry Nassar claims correctly, that filed through a series of CEOs. Some had embarrassingly short tenures, like Mary Bono, who the former representative from California. That might go away. pay, but then there'll be bankruptcy and claims to pay in the meantime.
Okay. All right. Well, we don't have very cheery sports news, so let's continue with it. In the NFL, because they're dealing with another domestic violence incident, TMZ posted that video last Friday showing Kareem Hunt kicking a woman. This was in a Cleveland hotel. It was a security camera. And it was last February. Now, the NFL quickly suspended Hunt and his team, the Kansas City Chiefs, released him. He's abjectly apologized, said he's embarrassed about it. Where does this case stand?
Right now, if Kareem Hunt is or does come back into the game, he would be on a list of commissioners, the commissioner's exempt list. And normally he'd be having to serve a 6-game suspension. But now there are reports that he might have to serve more than a 6-game suspension. Why? Because it's particularly embarrassing or high profile for the league, but only after the videos have come out. So the NFL has a problem. And the problem isn't just that of its 1,600 employees who are players, and there's more than that on staff. And if you count everyone who wears an NFL uniform, it's like 2,000 employees. There's going to be some law breaking. Some of it will be horrendous to witness. But they have a problem with consistency, and they have a problem with enforcement. After the Ray Rice case, which we all remember, which was so similar in that it was a talented running back using violence against women captured by hotel security camera. After that, I think the owners and the league told itself, well, we have this taken care of going forward, except for the fact that the next time something extremely similar surfaces, they don't have it handled. And until the videotape comes out, Kareem Hunt isn't even talked about as having transgressed when, of course, he did, horribly
right.
so.
Right. Look, is it we got about a minute left. I mean, I'm going to repeat a question I think I've asked you 10 times. Is it time to change the top leadership at the NFL?
I don't see what Roger Goodell does for anyone except make the owners richer. But here's the thing. Making the owners richer is not one of the few priorities of the NFL owners. It is the priority. So he makes, the last time it was publicly disclosed, he makes 30-something million a year. He could be paid $40 million a year. And the NFL, we talked about this last week, they're actually having a rating spike unlike everything else in television. Those owners are getting richer and richer and richer. And I think Roger Goodell will continue to hold on to a highly remunerative job so long as that stays the case.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, boy, they got to be talking to football players about this domestic violence and remind them, hey, there's cameras now, guys. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, also editor of the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. And I didn't mean to be flip there. I mean, really, they got to do something about this domestic violence problem.
Agreed.
Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.